Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Okay, so we discussed that for one who is on this platform, Yoga Rudha, who's attained to the super soul, then he's not affected by the dualities of the world. Right? So that's the common. He's not affected by the dualities. They don't bother him. He's not interested, or let's say it means hot, cold, or nice, or not nice, or whatever it may be, that doesn't bother him. Right, so that's just as a situation. Then we see, so that's the common platform. Then within that, then the two levels of where one sees everything equally. Right? And so there's nothing of value to him in the world. Right? So that's on the way of things, situations, facilities. Right? So first of all, they're not affected by the situations. Two, they're not attracted by the situations. And then the higher level is then even within relationships, one is able to be equal poised. Right? So then one is able to see everything in connection with the Lord. Right? So point being made is that if the mind is controlled, then the super soul is reached. Right? Because what is in the way? Right? If you control the mind, then what's between you and the Lord? What's the obstacle? Right? Because you don't have the material intelligence, right? Because the mind will control the intelligence, or be controlled by that mundane intelligence. So that means that if it's controlling the intelligence, means it's not controlled. If it's being controlled by the material intelligence, still on the material platform, it's not controlled. So if the mind is actually controlled, that means what is it being controlled by? Yeah, the spiritual intelligence, by consciousness of the Lord. So that means the controlled mind is in contact with the super soul. You understand? Right. Very simple. Verses 10 to 32, the practice of... So that's the whole point of the yoga system, is to control the mind. Right? Yeah? So what's will be pointed out is, here is the yoga system, how it goes through all the stages of the yoga system. Right now that we're going to deal with the practice. But the point ultimately is that this practice, instead of it being done like this, then you come to the point of remembering the Lord, then you take up the devotional process, you take it up right from the beginning, the devotional process. So, because the other, you're following nice karma, but it's not actually connected to the Lord. Right, but for the devotees, they follow Naishkarmya right from the beginning. Right, so they already have that benefit. Right, does that make sense? Because Naishkarmya is going to free you from material entanglement. That's just the way it works. You practice Naishkarmya, then you will get freed from material entanglement. But that doesn't mean you'll go back to Godhead. Right, going back to Godhead is another point. Right? Just because you got yourself out of the house doesn't mean you got yourself into a different situation. You're just not in the situation you were in. Right? We take it they're simultaneous. Why would we take them as simultaneous? Because liberation we consider as the ultimate, spirituality. You understand? But it's not. It's just normal. Right? Now, so in other words, being in the material world is negative. Right? Coming to the liberated platform, now you're just in the neutral state. Now, developing love for Krishna, that's the positive. Does that make sense? So that's what we're trying to do. Because otherwise the problem is when you go from the negative, you have something. When you go to the neutral state, then you have nothing. But still, that nothing is better than not than being in the negative on one level.
For some time.
Yes, for some time. On one aspect it is. On another aspect, at least the nature of the soul is being engaged. Right? So that's why the karma is the most efficient element. Right? It drives all the others. Because activity is the principle of the soul. The soul is active. It should be active for Krishna. So if it's active not for Krishna, but a person is active, then you can take that activity, connect that to Krishna. They'll become purified. That will bring them naturally to the neutral state. But because they're active, they won't stop at the neutral state. They'll keep going until they obtain Krishna. Right? So, but how will you obtain Krishna unless you have a goal? Right? Means activity won't happen unless there's a goal. Right? Because thinking, feeling, willing. Unless there's feeling that there's a goal. Oh, that's yours. Okay. The sock. The singing sock. So, because there's a goal, there's action. So what's going to prompt activity on the liberated platform when there's no need for activity? Does that make sense? In other words, to appreciate the Brahman platform needs no activity. Does that make sense? So what will prompt one for something further?
Activity.
Yes, but what will create that activity? Because unless there's a goal, there's no activity. Okay, but where will that come from? Yes.
Association.
Association, right? In other words, by association, then with the devotees, in other words, bhakti comes from bhakti, so the devotees have that, so then one gains that from them. So if that goal is already there beforehand, then one is not distracted or bewildered at the platform of liberation. One just continues. Right? Does that make sense? Because we have to understand, the liberated platform is neither here nor there. Right? You're situated on the spiritual platform, but because there's not love for Krishna, then one won't go into the spiritual world. You understand? But because there is no, how you say? And because there's no proper understanding, then one can get distracted. And there's no good association, one can get distracted and become attracted by the material energy. You understand? So it's not a very nice position. Because if you put the two together, we say the impersonalist goes to the Brahman platform. How long does he stay? Right? It's a temporary time. Why? Because he needs activity. Does that make sense? So that means it is not natural for the soul to be inactive. So to be on the liberated platform is not a natural position. Right? It's a starting position, but it's not a natural position. The natural position is love of God. Right? Does that make sense? So the reason that this is pointed out again and again, otherwise why do we even bother with this? Right? Two things. One is that we think that obtaining liberation is something important, right? It's a material concept, and being overwhelmed by material concepts, that's why we're here, then we think it's a value, right? We think it's important. But the other thing is that when by the performance of devotional service, you know, this nice karma aspect within devotional service, you will be liberated. And then when you get to that liberated position, one should not make the same mistake you did before. Is not take developing love for Krishna seriously. Not take up good association seriously. Just comfortable to remain in that neutral state. Right? Because if you don't move forward to Krishna, you have to move backwards to the material energy. Yes?
Does the devotee necessarily come to a neutral point where he's not one or the other?
No, the devotee already has a goal, so therefore that's why we call it Brahma-bhuta. It's not exactly just liberated, it's not just mukti, because he already has the goal. But the point is the position of liberation doesn't have that goal. Right? It has that knowledge, but the point is this knowledge is not enough for activity. There has to be the goal, there has to be that inspiration. And that is gained by association. So if you don't have a little bit of the idea, you won't get the association that will develop that. You know what I'm saying? If you have a little desire, then by association you can make that substantial. But if there's no interest, why would you take up association? Does that make sense? So in other words, this element of association is just as it is important now, it's going to be that important later. One thinks, oh, well, I'm liberated now, everything's fine. No, that's then, if you don't have good association, it's not going to work out great either. You understand? So association is the most important thing. So that's why, from this stage, then we try to practice that. We try to develop that. Does that make sense? So that's why, if one doesn't appreciate the association of devotees and all that, then the situation is actually sad, because now you may think it doesn't matter, but later on, then where are you going to go? Right? Of course, one may say, oh, but then those devotees are, you know, perfect, so naturally I can surrender unto them and be able to associate, but that's a detail. That they are perfect and you surrender, that's a detail. The principle is, do you appreciate the association of devotees? Right? One should be in the association of devotees. That's the principle. The detail is therefore those who are more advanced. You understand? So if you can't appreciate it here, you won't appreciate it there. Right? Think of all the demons who came to Vrindavan. Now, what is Vrindavan full of? Devotees. Now, did they coming to Vrindavan, because they were in Mathura, right? So they're with Kamsa and all these other demons, right? Then they come to Vrindavan, and there's all these devotees. Then they go, wow, this is great, the association of Vaishnavas and all this and all that. And so then they took up devotional service, right? Isn't that what happened? No, they're right there, and they couldn't care less. Why? Because they can't see. You understand? So the point is that means from now we have to appreciate. If we appreciate, then the whole journey of Krishna consciousness is very easy. That's the key, the association of devotees. If we don't have that, then it's not going to be very easy. Does that make sense? Okay. Verses 10 to 32, the practice of Astanga Yoga. Having described the Yoga Ruta stage, Krishna now explains how to practice yoga in that stage, right? Right? So in other words, you're going to do all these different activities, but unless you actually understand the goal and how it works, right? So we're connecting Naishkarmya with yoga, right? Naishkarmya is the first six stages, but we've learned Naishkarmya in connection with the Lord. Astanga Yoga connects it to the Lord, but you're not actually doing anything in connection with the Lord until Yoga Ruta. Right? So here is that now we've connected this devotional service and the Yoga Ruta stage of meditating upon the Lord. This is the valuable stage. You know, this is basically your liberated stage. So that has been connected to the Naishkarmya that's been described in the previous chapters. Right? So we can see that this is what's valuable. So you start with what's most valuable. You start with the principle, the connection, showing how it's connected with devotional service and all that. Then after they get into the lower detail. Then you talk about the kusasan and the deer skin and not too high, not too low and all this stuff, right? But that's the part that Arjuna is going to have problem with, right? The principle is not going to have any problem with. You can't have a problem with the principle, right? It means unless you're, you know, in high school or something. But other than that, then you can't have a problem with the principle, because it's always applies. Okay. The yogi must concentrate the mind by remaining in seclusion and avoiding disturbance from external objects. In his purport to verse 10, Srila Prabhupada explains how all these rules are perfectly executed in bhakti yoga. All these perfections and precautions are perfectly executed when one is directly in Krishna, directly in Krishna consciousness. Because direct Krishna consciousness means self-abnegation, wherein there is very little chance for material possessiveness. A Krishna conscious person knows well that everything belongs to Krishna, and thus he is always free from feelings of personal possession. As such, he has no hankering for anything on his own personal account. He knows how to accept things in favor of Krishna consciousness and how to reject things unfavorable to Krishna consciousness. He is always aloof from material things because he is always transcendental. And he is always alone, having nothing to do with persons not in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, a person in Krishna consciousness is the perfect yogi. Right? So, okay, let's come to the next verse. Okay, let's go through the next verse also. In this section, Krishna gives strict rules and regulations for focusing the mind on the Supersoul. The yogi must be devoid of sex life and fear, because they are obstacles for advancement in yoga, right? What's sex life and fear? What are some other terms we could use? Philosophical terms.
Gain and safety.
Gain and safety. Okay. Something else?
Raga
dvesha. Attachment and fear or desire, like that, or the purusha bhav, controller and enjoyer. And that's the last one I'll think of, right? Because that's perfectly normal. I mean, you understand? So it's the same thing, because fear is the problem, is why are you afraid? Because you're not in control, right? And sex life will be, you're at least around here, considered the highest of all varieties of enjoyment, right? In other words, what controlling something, what's the maximum you can get at it would be connected with this, right? And so fear would be taking the control to its farthest in the other way. Right? Does that make sense? Because your fear, because something else is in control. You want to be in control. Right? Makes sense? So it's the same thing. Just there's all these different aspects that come out. One has to know the connection. Otherwise, they're just different things, and you have so many things, and how do you remember all those things? But the principle, that you can always see. Right? So even if you can't remember so much variety, you know the essence. Srila Prabhupada writes in the purports to verses 13 through 14, one has to practice controlling the mind and avoiding all kinds of sense gratification. Right? This is now about talking about how yoga works. It means this is Sangha Yoga. Avoiding all kinds of sense gratification, of which sex life is the chief. No one can perform correct yoga practice through sex indulgence. Brahmacharya is taught, therefore, from childhood, when one has no knowledge of sex life. Children at the age of 5 are sent to the Gurukul, or the place of the spiritual master. And the master trains the young boys in the strict discipline of becoming brahmacharis. Without such practice, no one can make advancement in any yoga, whether it be dhyana, jnana, or bhakti. Right? So without that training, you're not going to be successful in anything. One who, however, follows the rules and regulations of married life, having a sexual relationship only with his wife, and that also under regulation, is also called a brahmachari. Such a restrained household of brahmachari may be accepted in the bhakti school, but the jnana and dhyana schools do not even admit household of brahmacharis, right? Shankara was in the Jnana school. And if householders came up and started discussing philosophy seriously, he'd say, first take sannyas, then we'll talk. Because as a householder, you won't be able to have entrance into this system. So why waste your time? Either go away or take sannyas. You know. They require complete abstinence without compromise. In the bhakti school, a householder brahmachari is allowed controlled sex life because of the cult of bhakti yoga is so powerful that one automatically loses sexual attraction, being engaged in the superior service of the Lord. So this is very important. That there's no means the devotional process is dealing with the cultivation of emotions or sentiments towards Krishna. But that does not mean it's not scientifically based. Right? Because if we don't see the scientific base and we only have the emotions, then one, at best you can call that neophyte. Right? Because what's the definition of the neophyte devotee? Right? He has sentiment for Krishna but doesn't know the philosophy. So he can be easily distracted from that. Or if he's really fixed, then he can't be distracted but he still has no idea what you'd say. You know? Does that make sense? So that's the definition. That's at best. And if it starts, they start making up their own ideas. That you get the sahajya, right? That you're learning in nectar devotion. No? The sahajya, he makes up his own process. But it's based on the emotion. As long as emulsion can be cultivated, that's his goal. While in the actual bona fide line, as long as you're spiritually developing and moving forward, that's the point. And the ultimate goal is that relationship with Krishna. But their point is as long as emotions are being felt, then it's fine. So whatever you can do to cultivate those emotions, you know, in some way seemingly connected to Krishna, then that's fine. That's sahajya. Right? Does that make sense? So these are the two sides of the razor's edge. One side is sahajya, one side is the impersonal. Right? So we've discussed the impersonal a lot. Sahajya we don't discuss as much. You know, that will come up. I mean, that's in the nectar devotion, but it'll come up in the future class when we get into the, what do you call it? Jiva Dharma, then that will be dealt with quite a lot. Also in the Tattva Vivek. So, there is the sentiment, but you must be able to explain it scientifically, how it's working. Right? So it's not a matter of just, oh, the bhakti can do anything. No, but here Prabhupada's saying, is that they can admit the householder brahmachari. Right? He is part of the system because the devotional process is so powerful. Now, why will it work? Right? Bhakti is more powerful than anything, but the point is are we in tune with bhakti? That's the problem. The problem is not that the holy name is not powerful. The problem is we're not interested in the holy name. So now, if one is engaged in sexual relationships without regulation, then where is the scope for being aware of the spiritual content? Right? He's just chanting the holy name. We see that there are those who take up the chanting. They give up everything on the spot. But that's because they're somehow or another, by the Lord's grace, they're appreciating. Right? So one can appreciate if that regulation is there. That's the importance of it. That's why the Shastra regulates everything in your life, because that means everything, you're doing things in your life. Why? Because of material attachment. Right? And so, therefore, all those things are connected to the Lord, so that then you're purified, you're elevated. And as you become purified, then, as Rupa Goswami mentions, then that jaundice of material attachment, as it gets less, one is able to appreciate the sweetness of, you know, chanting the holy name. Right? The holy name's always sweet, just we don't perceive it that way. It's not that we're chanting a lower state so we have a lower level of the holy name. No, the holy name's always the same. Does that make sense? It's us who changes. Right? So in this, then we can see is that the devotee, going back to the previous thing, is that all these rules and regulations of the Astanga Yoga system is perfectly accomplished in Krishna consciousness. Right? It's the highest and most powerful of all the yoga systems. So that means then the devotee, he's directly connecting everything to Krishna consciousness. Right? The yogi is not. He's conscious of Krishna. But in Rupa Goswami, in his definition, then where do they stop? Right? Okay, they're conscious. right? So that's dharana. They're focused, so they're conscious. Then they focus on the Supreme, on the Super Soul. So then they're Krishna conscious. But then, it's not, is it favorable to Krishna? Why are they focusing on Krishna? They want mystic city, they want liberation, they want to merge into the Lord. Something they want. So is that favorable? No. And is it with free from karma jnana? No, because they, you know, they either want mystic cities, which is karma, or liberation, which is jnana. So it doesn't come into the definition of pure devotional service. You know, or even devotional service at all, because it's not favorable to the Lord.
Where did it go wrong with these yogis?
Where did it go wrong?
Yeah, it seems they got pretty much everything together, then they choose poorly.
Because, means you have, see, in the material world, are people kind of like, on one level, naturally inclined to doing what's correct?
No.
On one level, not. But let's say personally, if you put it between two things, do they kind of have a conscience a little bit? Yeah, a little bit they have. But, you know, the tendency by association and by the atmosphere surcharge, they will generally end up doing something wrong. So, therefore, it's not unnatural for a living entity to want to do some pious thing. And also the concept that you get a result from work. Right? So you combine those two, therefore there's all these processes of elevation. Right? But does that mean you're interested in God consciousness? No. So that means there has to be all these processes of karma, jnana, and yoga that are there for the living entity who is inclined towards pious deeds and wants to elevate himself, but at the same time is still not interested in God consciousness. You understand? Yeah. So basically what you've done is taken the devotional process and just broken it up into parts so people take this or people take that.
So as not to frighten them off.
Yeah, because they don't want it. The point is if they wanted it, why would they be here? You know what I'm saying? Because the tathasta means you can see the spiritual, you can see the material. So that means we can see. And spiritual doesn't mean Brahman. Because soul is sat chit ananda. Because Brahman is sat. So that means we can see the spiritual activities. Right? But we don't choose that. We choose the reflection of the material world. So what does that say from the start?
We've already chosen poorly.
So now just within it, now you have, you know, worse and more worse choices within the material world. You know what I'm saying? So that's... Can I say something? No. Does that make sense? So there's very little cause for material possessiveness. Right? This is very important because possessiveness, what does it do? Right? On the means if we're looking just on what we were discussing before, the philosophical aspects.
It creates attachment.
It creates attachment. And?
Reaction.
It gets a result, so you get some more things from it. Attachment means you'll work, you'll get more results. Where do those results go? You get a result from Prayojana. Where does it go?
Sambandha.
Goes back to Sambandha. What does that create in Sambandha?
More facilities.
More facilities. So that would be, as far as these points we're discussing here, in the relation to fear, what will it create? It means more facilities create more fear?
Control.
Control. Security. Safety. Right? So, therefore, if there's material possessiveness, then all this comes up. So if there's no material possessiveness, one's not material entangled. It's that one thing. That's why then it always concentrates on naishkarmya, giving up the result. Because if you give up the result, then it's not a matter of your enjoyment. And then when the result is gained, it's not yours when it moves back to Sambandha. It's still Krishna's opportunity for service. So it doesn't create fear. It doesn't create material, security. You're not dependent upon the material energy. Right? Because it's for Krishna. Why would it be for Krishna? Why would you come to the conclusion it's for Krishna? Right? In Sambandha. Natural position. In other words, you're seeing the nature of the soul. Right? You're seeing God, you're seeing the soul, you're seeing material energy. So that's sammana jnana. So by that, then you understand this is for Krishna. You understand? So therefore, when you see like that, you'll endeavor like that. When you get that result, it'll come back and there's more for you to see like that. In other words, it'll increase your sambandha jnana, your understanding, your realization. That will increase your determined endeavor and your good results in Krishna consciousness. Right? See, it nourishes itself. It goes on and on. This is the natural perpetual motion machine here. Right? But so now we see, Prabhupada's bringing this out in relationships. Some of them say, oh, this is just dry philosophy. This is not. Possessiveness, material possessiveness, that's what everything works on. It's yours. That's why you work for it. Right? There's a house there, and you're working hard paying the mortgage. Why are you paying the mortgage? It's your house. You're not paying the neighbor's mortgage. At least you don't think you are, you know, maybe. Of course, there may be a problem because he is your lawyer. You know, so, you know, maybe you should check up. Maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Okay? So, a Krishna conscious person knows well that everything belongs to Krishna. Right? So everything's already Krishna's. Now it's just a matter, we can take part in that. Right? You know, you may say, well, no, if it's not ours, it won't be fun. But you can go over to a friend's house and have fun. But you know everything in the house is theirs. So you deal with it appropriately. Right? But it enhances the relationship. So it's not a problem. And thus, he is always free from feelings of personal possession. Right? Because that's the problem. That's why the importance of doesn't see, you know, stones, pebbles, or gold. You know, it's not a problem. Because there's no possession. And then the next one, is then he doesn't see the people as possessive. Because can you possess a soul? No, you are a soul, but you can't possess one. Krishna possesses all souls. We can associate with souls, but we can't possess them. You know what I'm saying? So the only sense of real possession comes from association. You know what I'm saying? In the material world it comes, but is it based on the soul? Husband and wife, is that based on the soul? No, because you don't marry the souls. You marry the gross and subtle bodies. So that sense of possession is not based on the soul. But in the spiritual world, therefore relationships there are based on the nature of the soul as servant of Krishna. So that means those relationships are real. That's real friendship. So associating the devotees in the spiritual world, that's real friendship. Because the possessiveness is actually that of the soul. You understand? So we're seeing very clear, there's a reflection here. On one side it's perverted because it doesn't work properly. The other side is perfect. Right? So talking badly about the material energy is not that it exists and it works the way it works. Is that we're attached to it as opposed to being attached to, you know, the spiritual energy. That's the problem. But the things that are going on, that's why in bhakti, there's no problem with a householder. Right? Does that make sense? The spiritual world, do they have children? Yes. Right, yeah, at least in Goloka. Vaikuntha, you don't hear about it. But in Goloka, they have children. So, therefore, being married and having children isn't the problem. The problem is it's not seen in relationship to Krishna. Therefore, the regulation. You understand? Therefore, the regulation. And because Krishna is the important point, the household life is simply a medium for it. So it's not as important as the Krishna consciousness. You understand? So therefore, who wants to expand it? You understand? So the residents of the spiritual world aren't looking for, you know, further extramarital relationships because that's not the point. So if you want to be like them, then you have to be like that here. It's very scientific. It's not just, oh, it's bad, it's more. That's just morality. But who defines good and bad? Why isn't it good and bad? It's not good in the relationship with Krishna. Krishna is a central feature. Therefore, that's what you're trying to expand. And it's the medium, right? Does that make sense? He knows how to accept things in favor of Krishna consciousness, how to reject things unfavorable to Krishna consciousness. Okay, now that's yama and niyama. That's already the first point of yoga. So he knows why, because he doesn't have material possessiveness. He sees that relationship to Krishna. Therefore, it's easier to see what actually cultivates Krishna consciousness, what doesn't. But if we're clouded, then we're all going, oh no, but this is it's valuable to me, so we're trying to somehow or another connect it. There is a method, but the point is it becomes more difficult when there's material possession. If there isn't, then it's very easy. This is not favorable, it's just given up. But if there's material possession, then you're going to have to engage that possession in Krishna's service. How will that be done? Through regulation. Otherwise, Krishna's not going to just accept it any way you like. You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? He's always aloof from material things because he's always transcendental. So aloof, then you already is pratyahara. You know? He is always alone, right? We mentioned here he has to be alone, go to the holy place and not be involved in material entanglement. So he's involved in activities within the material environment, but they're not material because there's no possession. So that's the superiority of the bhakti. The other systems can't do that. They're dealing with the mundane mind and intelligence and body. So they have to put it in a perfect situation that you can go through mechanically and not get distracted. Then when you get to the point of absorption in the Lord, that's the point where it now could turn into bhakti. When you see the super soul, you could surrender and take up devotional service. But now for all that trouble, you could have just been doing devotional service from the beginning. Does that make sense? So it's just, devotional service is the superior bhakti process. We get distracted by the others because of our attachment, our material possession to karma and jnana. But otherwise, bhakti is the natural, it is the yoga system. These others are taking portions of them and then through advertisement trying to make them into something special. Right? That's why it says about these other things, you can consider an exaggeration. How happy you'll be on the heavenly planets and all that, what facilities you get and how happy you'll be with those facilities, that is exaggeration. You know, going to the Brahman, how happy you'll be there, that is exaggeration. Right? So you could say that about the scriptures, but they don't exaggerate, people aren't inspired. Right? Does that make sense? So, but devotional service, then it's not an exaggeration. That's why it's given. Because we're not used to it, because we don't deal with these areas. But the point is you go, you live for, you know, tens of thousands of years on the heavenly planets, and you have this, you know, very nice, you know, body, nice facilities, so much enjoyment and everything like that, you'll be really happy. So it sounds great here, so people are inspired. But when you get there, your experience is only going to be 100 years, so it's not going to be any longer than here. Right? And no matter, and what's your problem here? Right? What's the real problem here?
Death, old age.
Death, old age? Okay. Well, there you won't see the old age. You'll stay 16 and one day you'll just disappear. So that problem you won't have. But let's take socially. What are the social problems in this world? Possession. Okay, but now you just got out and bought a fancy car, so that puts you on the top of the pile in the whole world?
They're relative,
yes, but what's the problem?
Envy,
but why would there be envy? You have a great car. Yeah, they have a better car. Right? So the point is you have a great demigod body, but someone else has done more piety than you. He has a better demigod body. You have a nice mansion, he has a better one. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So the point is your capacity for enjoying the heavenly pleasures is going to be less than someone else. Of course there's going to be someone less than you, but still. So it's exactly the same thing. It's just, you know, in other words, how you say? You know, it's the difference between a soap opera that, you know, is down and, you know, just, you know, in the common people and that and one that's on the Upper East Side. Right? That's the only difference. It's the same thing. Just the paraphernalia is a little nicer. But the experience is exactly the same. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the exaggeration. Right? You know, just like in the morning when your alarm goes off, right? And then you can hit the snooze button, right? And that gives you a few more minutes. So somehow now that's really important at that time, right? And then after taking advantage of that, then when you finally do wake up, then you think how stupid that was because now you're late. Right? But at the time, that you know, however you said it for, that 5 more minutes is so important. So that's why then they can say, going to the heavenly planets and it's deathless. You're there, you know, it's like eternity. Because instead of being, you know, now you live 100 years, there you live 10,000 years. If it's the moon, or some of them even more, millions of years. You know? And then? Like one cycle of the, what do you call it? Of the four yugas is 4,300,000. 320,000 years, right? So Indra lives for 14 of those, right? So that means it's quite a few million years, but still to him it's only 100 years in his time frame. So for us it seems so long, but it's still is exaggerated. The time's over in no time, right? Does that make sense? Otherwise, you know, Indra would be so overwhelmed by the ecstasy of how long he's going to be there, he wouldn't care. Couldn't care less if others are doing yoga and this and that. But he's very careful. They're doing, and he doesn't want to lose any of his, you know, short stay there. Does this make sense? Okay. So, having nothing to do with persons not in Krishna consciousness. Because if they're not in Krishna consciousness, why would you want to be with them? Right? In other words, you associate with like-minded persons. That's the point. So Krishna conscious, that's the basis of like-minded. Then within there, then you have the detail. Right? Therefore, a person in Krishna consciousness is the perfect yogi. Right? He's in Krishna conscious, he's focused. So you're already there up to, you know, dharana, samadhi. Right? Pratyahara, he's pulled his senses away, he's alone. You know, yama niyama, he knows what to do, what not to do. So he situates himself properly. That's asanam. Right? He controls his activities, are engaged in Krishna's service. That's pranayama. You understand? So he's the perfect yogi. Right? Okay. Yes, so then yoga can only be accomplished through this ability to control. It means to the need to control and to enjoy. So what is being taught? What are brahmacharis being taught?
Sense control
and under what conditions?
Following authority,
right? So that's the two. So that puts it right there. You know, so you're not the controller, you're not the enjoyer. So that's how you're taught. In that environment, you gain knowledge and skills and character. Then when one practices grihastha life, one will still be a yogi. Right? Because one understands one's not in control. Right? It means you have to be a fool to think you're in control if you're married. Right? So, like that. But we won't talk any more about it, but like that. Okay? Does that make sense? So that element of working under others, sacrificing for others, that's the natural principle of the soul. That's the natural principle of relationship. So how are you going to have a relationship if you're not willing to sacrifice? So that sacrifice, that's what then makes it. And to do that, then how do you sacrifice? How do you know what to sacrifice? In what way? That comes from authority. Right? So Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, they define what is the sacrifice to be performed. Otherwise you make it up and it won't work. Right? When you make it up, it just doesn't work. But you say, oh no, but they're so spontaneous. Yeah, but they're spontaneous within what? Within things that work. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know? They're at the party and they decide to go, you know, swim in the pool. Okay, so that works. But they don't, you know, at the party decide to jump off the roof. You know what I'm saying? It would also be wild and crazy and, you know, really spontaneous, but would it work? No.
For a very short time.
Yeah, for a very short time. Extremely short time. Yeah. Does this make sense? So in other words, their spontaneity is still happening within a sphere of set rules. Just that by karma, they're able to somehow or another perceive these options, while others can't. They're not comfortable in others are not comfortable in the field. They're comfortable in the field. They can see the options in the field. They can work within those options. Therefore, you say, this person is very spontaneous. Right? Does that make sense? That's why, just for you know, an example, you have someone like Picasso. He paints these wild paintings, right? And they sell for millions of dollars. Others try to copy the same thing and do crazy stuff. Nobody could care less. Why? Because Picasso is actually a trained painter. So he paints within the regulations of painting. He just has very unique ways of presenting it. Well, these other guys don't actually know anything about painting. They just throw some stuff around. Because otherwise, if it was up to that, then, you know, like, you know, little kids and would be the greatest painters. They go into the kitchen. There's always a mess. They eat lunch. It's a mess. You could take a picture of that. It would be up, you know, every day would be a new... Like that. You know. Does that make sense? So it's because it's working within a framework. Does that make sense? Which is so interesting because the modern works like that. Modern music... You have a framework. You don't do one note different than's written on the paper. But after the performance, they go, oh, very nice, you know, presentation or interpretation or everything like that. Because they understand how much more to put into it, how much less, how much this, how much that. So it's within a framework they're using that spontaneousness. You understand? Or the Indian music. Whenever a musician plays, they will never play the same piece twice in the same way. Never. But it's based on a very strict system of music. It's exact. But within that, they can put it together in so many different ways. You know? Or cooking. There's strict rules of cooking. But if you understand the system, you can come up with unlimited variety. Because Radharani does. Right? Krishna's been playing with seven different notes as kind of a memorial, and still his music bewilders Brahma and Shiva, who are the best musicians within the material universe. And they are just, what is that? Does it make sense? So in other words, real spontaneity is coming within a structured field. In other words, it's with following the principles, but you are able to come up with all the variety of detail. So that means someone who's good in the material world at doing this only has the karma to be able to work with that detail because they're working on the principle. There's no such thing as you just do whatever you want. It doesn't work. Right? Did the Bohemians or the hippies, did they become successful? No. If they did, then maybe, you know, we have something, you know, we could say there's a flaw here in this presentation. But there, just do whatever you feel like, and then? You understand?
Ended up in the office, it's soon.
Yeah. That's the whole point. They ended up back in the office with the suits. And that was the smart ones. There are still some hippies. You know, these guys, 70-year-old guys, are still the same. Said the time you bumped into one, he came, this was quite a while ago, it would have been, I think, back in the 80s. So this is already 20 years later or something, you know. So he had come to the temple, and somehow or another, there was... In the morning, the devotees came out. He happened to have visited there. I think he was visiting Mayapur on his tour around and all this. And there was this whole scene happening in the street in front of the temple. And so the devotees went to see what was happening. There's like a terrace there. You can see what's going on down there. So what had happened is there was this light pole And there was a light, and there was a thief had climbed up the pole trying to steal the light. But in the process, he got electrocuted. Right? And so everybody's marveling at this insanity. You know, so Dwar is saying, you know, how stupid the guy is and this and that. And then the hippie says, no, he's actually quite elevated because he died reaching for the light. So that's a hippie. That's a pure unalloyed. Okay. The goal of Astanga Yoga is Paramatma realization. In verse 14, Krishna declares that in order to realize this goal, the yogi must include bhakti in his practice. Because there has to be something, because the Lord is there, so you have to somehow or another connect to Him. It may not be very high grade, but you have to connect to the Lord. Right? Karma, Gyan, or Astanga Yoga cannot award the desired success unless they have some connection with bhakti. This is a very important point. Right? Because there always is that aspect within it. Like you see, they're always doing some worship, some something, their dedication of the scriptures, because Krishna is the Shastra. You know, like that. There's always something that's there. So that little bit, that's what's awarding it. They're thinking it's their process of jnana, but it's not. It's its touch with bhakti. So that's what's actually giving the result. But because that's not what's of interest to them. Their path of jnana and their process of jnana, or their path of yoga and the process of yoga. That's what is important to them. So the little bit of bhakti that you use is a side thing for them. You know what I'm saying? Like your car. You want to go out, drive your car around, do whatever you want to do, go fast, slow, go through the corners, you know, right down the street, everyone looks, wow, you know, all this kind of stuff. But you have to put petrol in your car, right? So the point is, it's only working because of the petrol. But you don't really think about it. That's a side thing. You just have to fill it up with petrol, and then you do whatever you want. So this is why it gets mixed, is that the bhakti is not seen in its own stature. It's just seen as something that goes along with it. Does that make sense? So that's why they'll never take it seriously. They're the big thing, and then that's a small thing. Does that make sense? The process of jnana, for example, must include bhakti in order to award liberation, as it is stated in Bhagavad Gita 5:17. Following all these rules and regulations for control of body, mind, and activities, the yogi attains the abode of Krishna by cessation of material existence. Right? So Krishna will always go in and out of this yoga, showing the astanga, but going into bhakti, just like in jnana. He's showing the process, but going into bhakti, or karma is going into, because they're synonymous. You can separately deal with them, but otherwise their only meaning is their positions in relationship to the devotional process. In this verse, Shantim Nirvana Paramam does not refer to the Buddhist concept of voidism, but to cessation of the materialistic activities. Srila Prabhupada writes in The Path of Perfection. So in the practice of spiritual consciousness, all these activities are present, but they are spiritualized. Right? We discussed before, spiritualized means because you're seeing it as Krishna's energy, and therefore working with it, then that chit potency manifests to you as internal potency. Because remember, chit is beyond the spiritual manifestation and the material manifestation. Just as Krishna is beyond. You understand? So the chit potency includes both these energies. Then there's the specific manifestation, the spiritual, right? Which then you'll get Samvit, Sandini, and Hladini. Or the manifestation of the material, which you'll get, you know, goodness, passion, and ignorance. You understand? So the chit is beyond, includes both. Right? The cessation of material existence does not mean entering into the void, which is only a myth, right? Because there is no such thing as a void anywhere. I've heard it that there's something, someone else told, also confirmed it, but I don't know where, that because the Buddhists are so interested in the void, which means there's nothing, that they get put into the mud in the bottom of the Garbhodak ocean. Right there. Because there's no senses, no nothing. And so there they could feel its void. You know, just as the Brahmanandis, you know, get into the Brahman. Right? Like that. But they go into the Garbhodak mud. There's no void anywhere within the creation of the Lord. I am not void, but spirit soul. If I were void, how would my bodily development take place? Where is this void? If we sow a seed in the ground, it grows into a plant or a large tree. The seed is originally given by Krishna, placed in the womb of material nature, and thus many living entities are generated. How can one argue against this process? If the seed of existence is void, how has this body developed? Right? So in other words, if the source is void, how does things come from void? Right? And if they say it's illusion, but where did the illusion come from? So right there you have a problem, because if we're saying void or Brahman, and that's all there's no variety. The Mayavadi says no variety. The Buddhist says nothing there. Void means there is nothing. Right? So in other words, you'll just disappear. They'll say the perfection is the light. You just put out the candle. That's the reason. Yeah. And I'm sure that's great fun, right? So, you know, the problem is that where is it? How could it work? How could you have? Where would this illusion come from that creates all this? And where would all this variety come out of nothing? If nothing's the greatest, then why all this variety? And if that's there, why do they spend time doing months with all these mandalas that has so much variety? You know what I'm saying? There's no connection. So it's only through this little bit of bhakti that's in it that it actually makes the thing work. Yes?
What's the relationship between Buddhism and atheism? Is it basically the same thing?
It's the same thing. It's just a matter of... Basically, Buddhism means that it's a philosophy of pessimism. It's a form of gyan. You know, it's like you could say the most extreme form of gyan, where they're pessimistic about material enjoyment. You know, well founded. But their conclusion is that therefore giving up all material activity, and since material activity is illusory, therefore when you give it up, then there'll be nothing. You know, so that's how they get so. You know, so and the lightest forms of it will be, you know, like your Western pessimist that, you know, there's nothing, you know, good comes out of anything. You know, like your existential, do I exist, and this and that, all these kind of things, where they're a bit negative on material enjoyment, on one sense, but in the other sense, they're generally very, what would the word be? You know, grossly, very hedonistic, you know, like that. So is it in there? Well, your gyan, I mean your karma, then is that, you know, most extreme is, you know, we are the body and it's come from material energy, and therefore by the combination of matter, then life has been generated, and when this life's over, then that's it. You know, so therefore enjoy whatever you can now, because that's all. So that's the extreme the other way. You know, and then everything else is kind of, you know, somewhere in between or a combination. But Buddhism, basically, the principle of it, what makes it different than, let's say, the impersonalism, though it's a form of impersonalism, is that they don't accept the Vedas. So that's why they're atheists, because automatically you don't accept the Vedas, you're automatically an atheist, because the Vedas are talking about God, so you don't know about God, so you're an atheist. So they're atheists. While, let's say, in the Vedas, there's atheistic philosophies, but their basis is not actually atheistic. Their interpretation is atheistic, but the Buddhism, its basis is atheistic. So naturally, their interpretation is going to be that way. Yes.
When you undergo anesthetic, something like that, or in a coma, are you actually unconscious? I guess is that an actual?
The void, but there is no void. So you have to go into something. Void, the concept of void is there's nothing there. But the point is, even if you take void, what's holding that void? What's allowing that space to be? So just that there is nothingness, that means there's space. So the void is actually filled up with space. You know what I'm saying? So generally you think of it as dark because there's nothing, because light would be something. So if you have an experience where you aren't able to perceive anything because of the darkness, right? There's no engagement for the senses, there's nothing for the mind, the intelligence. Then we call that void. You understand? So one could look for that experience. You know, or if you add the light to it, then that experience. Does that make sense? So your deep sleep or that unconscious state means that you're still within God's creation. Right? Just that basically you're just merged into the form of the Lord. Right? Does that make sense? So that's what's gained. So the merged into the form of the Lord in that state where there's nothing, there's no consciousness, or merged into the Lord where there's consciousness, or merged into material endeavor. These are basically the three options for the conditioned soul. Does that make sense? So, being merged into the Lord, that's generally in sleeping, the end of creation, these kind of things. Or, merged into the Brahman, then you have that element, the Vasudev Sattva, as we mentioned, the Mahat. When Krishna glances, the living entities, goes into Pradhan, then it's alive. There's that energy. But there's no distinguishing of form. Not at least for the living entity. Living entity can't appreciate it until the secondary creation. Right? In the primary creation, there is variety. But that's what those who are actually on the Brahman platform appreciate. Right? It means the variety of the Lord and His energies interactions. Right? Does that make sense? So in other words, one is just going into existence in Krishna's existence. So one merges into Krishna. Right? And that's why that deep sleep is considered refreshing. Because you're actually associating with Krishna. But you're not conscious of that. You know, just like the blood goes by the soul, so it gets energy. That's why it is energized. We think it's the heart. No, it's because it goes by the soul. So it pictures up consciousness and energy. So that's what permeates the body. Does that make sense? Right? Well, the dreaming state, then you're absorbed in the material activity, so you don't actually rest because you're still active, but subtly, but not grossly. Is that okay? Yeah. No questions about the silver thread. Okay. In verses 16 to 17, the Lord warns about some other obstacles for the aspiring yogi. He should be regulated in eating, sleeping, recreation, and work. In this way, he will be free from material miseries by practicing yoga. Right? So unless there's regulation, you can't develop spontaneity. Right? That spontaneity is only in relationship with the Lord. Spontaneity in the material world, right? You know, that hasn't worked out so great. That's the line where, so how did that work out for you? Right? You know, so, like that. So here we see eating, that's what we understand, sleeping, okay, recreation and work. Because you have your work, then you have that which makes it so you're comfortable to do your work. But there has to be a balance. It means your recreation can't disturb the work. Right? That it has to support the work. It has to enhance the work. Does that make sense? Right? And recreation, then, if we actually look at it, we're only going to pull that because we've dealt with others basically. But recreation, because it's something that generally devotees don't discuss very much, right? Now, in recreation, then, but what's the principle of what's the principle of relationship? Right? To make it work, what do you have to do?
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice, right? Right, because so the whole thing is we're trying to do everything as sacrifice, as an offering. So the point is that sacrifice means you're voluntarily giving up something for someone else's pleasure, right? So then recreation means the same thing. Does this make sense? So in other words, recreation is a change from your normal work environment. It doesn't mean you're doing any less activity. Right? Take your family on vacation. Right? It's as much or more than regular work because there's the element of sacrifice. But if we are thinking, oh, but, you know, where was my time? But the point is what is my time? Is there such a thing as actually my time? My time means I engage the senses, means you have to serve the senses. So that's dead matter. So you might as well be serving some moving dead matter. You know, walking and talking dead matter. You understand? It's a higher principle. You understand? So this idea that I will enjoy myself alone, that doesn't happen. No, alone, you should be pulled out from that material concept and be connected to Krishna. But as a bhakti yogi, it doesn't mean you're not playing your part within the, you know, how you say, the overall scheme of things. Does this make sense? Yes? No? Yeah. So just to put recreation in perspective.
Could recreation be connecting to Krishna?
Can be whatever it is that you are inspired to do, that, you know, like that. So, you know, do kirtan for Krishna, cook for Krishna, whatever it is you like to do. You know?
Yeah.
In other words, your recreation, it means recreation is going to be made out of elements of your work or your ashram. Right? In other words, there's only varna and ashram, right? There isn't another category. Right? Because Manu very clearly says there's four ashrams and four varnas. He says there's not another position. There isn't anything else other than this. So that means then, like brahmachara, you know, it goes through these different things. So when you have, so family, it means for brahmachari, vanaprastha, sannyasa, okay, it's very simple. Ashram means sadhana, right? And the lifestyle that goes with the sadhana, support of that sadhana. Right? In other words, the direct activities themselves and whatever it is that you need to do to so that you can do that. Okay? But then if you add family life with grihastha, that means so family life has to be seen in connection with sadhana. Right? In other words, it itself has to be a sadhana, though this is indirect. Right? It's not direct service to Krishna, but it's indirect in that you're taking all those activities within in the family environment and connecting those to Krishna. So therefore it's a sadhana. Right? So recreation, then you have your work. So something that goes off of that, but it still has to be the element of sacrifice, because work means doing your duties, the sacrifice. So recreation has to be in the same light. So if it's in relationship to your ashram, then it also has to be in the same light. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, it will be, you know, be if it's, you know, just a personal thing, it'll be a hobby, you know, and if it's a shared thing, then that will be, you know, whatever activity is there. Does that make sense? So in other words, means it's an activity that's not what maintains you, right? Occupation maintains you, hobby doesn't. Some people turn their hobby into their occupation. But the point is it's not your occupation. So, does that make sense? Just like in the ashram, those things that are separate, they support the main, right? You do your hobby, then you're more inspired to do your occupation. There's some recreation, then you're more inspired to perform your sadhana and family duties. You understand? So it has to be seen in light of that. Because for us, idea recreation is doing whatever you want, crazy, it's nothing to do with Krishna. But that's not the meaning of recreation. Just like eating, you know, doesn't have that connotation, or sleeping, or working. So why would recreation? Otherwise it would be inconsistent. Right? And then why would Krishna mention it? After going through all this trouble, why would he mention something that's you know, not connected with Krishna consciousness? Right? Verses 18 to 23. The Lord describes the advanced yogi. He is regulated in his mental activities and is situated in transcendence. He is not dependent on the dictations of his mind. Rather, the mind has come under his control. nor is his mind turned off or extinguished, because it is the yogi's duty to think always of Krishna. Right? Because the yogi is absorbed. So this is Dhyana Yoga, how to absorb yourself in Krishna. Such an advanced yogi, right? So he's regulated his mental activities means he's in control of the mind. Right? But the point is his mind still is accepting or rejecting. The point is now it'll only choose within what is favorable to Krishna consciousness. Right? He means accept what's favorable, reject what's not favorable. That's what makes him the perfect yogi. Right? While before is it may or may not be favorable, the mind is accepting and rejecting. That's the problem. So it's not the problem that the mind accepts and rejects. Right? The point is that it, so you don't have to get rid of it, like the Mayavadis or the Buddhists think. Right? It's that the mind is just accepting that which is connected to Krishna, and it becomes useful. Is this okay? Right. Therefore, it's neither turned off nor extinguished. That's why it says tune in, drop out, not turn off. You know, like that, okay? Such an advanced yogi is devoid of material desires. Actually, it is not possible to become desireless. The desire for sense gratification must be overcome by the process of purification. But the desire for service to Krishna should be cultivated. Right? In other words, in a reflection, the point is there's what's reflected and then there's what's original. So you want to get back to what's original. So the mistake is thinking that the reflection is actually what's important. No, it's what is being reflected is what's important. You know, what's important? The nose in the mirror or your actual nose? Right? You know, so that's the point, is you're trying to get to the original. Right? So, therefore, it's not a matter of stopping the desires, it's transferring them. But, because we are so accustomed and so practiced at material endeavor, we'll regulate or control that, or even stop that, so that we can reconsider and develop a new habit, which is actually real activity connected to Krishna. Does this make sense? Right? Because the problem is we're doing the material, the problem is that it's not connected to Krishna, not the activity. It said it's not connected to Krishna. So you want to bring it in line with what's the original. So if we can't tell the difference, then better not to deal with it. Does that make sense? That's why one starts off. What does, when the brahmachari first comes to the temple, right? What do they do? Are they engaged in a lot of indirect activities? No, basically as much direct as, and it has basically nothing to do with whatever they've done before. Right? Who's washed that many pots before becoming a devotee? You know, like that. Very rare, right? Very rare. I mean, I have heard of one or two devotees that they found them washing pots somewhere, but otherwise, generally, you know what I'm saying? So all they're doing is chanting and doing that, taking prasad, of course, very important, you know, going on Hari Nam, book to speech, everything like that. So they're engaged like that, so they start to distinguish and get the taste, understand the philosophy and get the taste for Krishna consciousness. Then as one matures, then one can start to look at one's position, one's conditioned position, and then look at that, okay, how much do I need to be involved in material activities? Not so, well, let's say, in activities that are indirect, right? Because we're working here on the principle of so-called material, right? So then, but in maturity, then you can look at them properly and you can see how to regulate them and connect them to Krishna. But if one can't see how to regulate and connect to Krishna, better to don't deal with it. Because it'll only entrap you. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the whole process, is how to pull one's mind out. So you're not overcome by the sense gratification, but you control the mind through the process of purification. Right? Then you're able to cultivate Krishna consciousness, because it's two different things. Right? There's the direct and the indirect. Right? So you have to cultivate the direct. You have to cultivate, you know, service to Krishna, chanting the holy name, the association of the devotees, the worship of the deity. One has to cultivate that. That's what will get you into the spiritual world. Remember, liberation will only get you out of the material world. But it's that devotion, cultivating the devotion to Krishna, that will get you into the spiritual world. Yes?
Mark, in the spiritual world, do devotees engage in indirect?
Do devotees engage in indirect? What's indirect there? What would be an example?
They're not directly with Krishna, but they're doing...
Yeah, but what are they doing? Let us say you're in the kitchen cooking lunch for the deity. Is that direct or indirect?
Direct.
Okay. Let us say you have an inordinate, attraction to cooking and all the different techniques of cooking and all that. So engaging that, what is that?
Indirect.
That's indirect, right? But since you're cooking for the deity, you've connected your indirect directly to Krishna. Right, so that's why the direct are so good, because they take things that are naturally indirect and connect them to Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. So therefore, everything they do is directly connected to Krishna. That's the facility that they're given, because that's their mentality. Is that okay? A yogi who is free from material desires is always steady in his meditation on Paramatma. In order to become steady and determined, the yogi should practice brahmacharya. Srila Prabhupada explains in The Perfection of Yoga, when a candle is in a windless place, its flame remains straight and does not waver. The mind, like the flame, is susceptible to so many material desires that with the slightest agitation, it will move. A little movement of the mind can change the whole consciousness. Therefore, in India, one seriously practicing yoga traditionally remained brahmachari, or celibate. There are two kinds of brahmachari. One is completely celibate, and the other is grihastha brahmachari. That is to say, he has a wife, but he does not associate with any other woman, and his relations with his own wife are strictly regulated. In this way, either by complete celibacy or restricted sex life, one's mind is kept from being agitated. Right, so that's the whole point, is that these things will take the mind away. So, therefore, the regulative principles, they're the things that will take the mind away in the greatest possible manner. Right? It means if someone gets too absorbed in intoxication, what happens? You lose austerity, but I'm just saying, you take a man on the street. He's so absorbed in intoxication. What eventually happens? Becomes irresponsible.
Ignorance,
right? You know, they can kill themselves from this or ruin themselves, right? Say someone gets overwhelmed with gambling.
Gambles all his money.
Yeah, just lose everything. In other words, everything he has, he can lose. He can lose it through intoxication. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Illicit sex, how much of that gets distracting? Right? If sex is regulated, it's not so distracting. Illicit sex, that becomes more distracting. Right? Regulated sex, he's at home with the family, he's interacting, he's at the office, he does his work. If there's illicit sex, then when he's at home with the family, he's thinking of something else. When he's at work, he's thinking of something else. So it means he can't perform his duties. Right? And meat-eating then creates a mentality that one can't distinguish the soul. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So, in other words, to satisfy your palate, you're willing to kill other people. So that means there's the least amount of austerity, and austerity means proper performance of your duties. Right? So the actual performance, real duty, is the soul, and their relationship to Krishna. Right? So that means there has to be that austerity. So meat eating is going to take one farthest away. So the main point is not the mercy, it's the austerity. Because generally the devotees switch the two. Like that. They take meat eating as mercy. No, intoxication is mercy. drug dealers, are they very merciful to others? No. But meat eaters can be. Right? Right? But drug dealers can be quite austere. But meat eaters aren't. You understand? So it's austerity that's the main effect. You know, out of a sense of morality, we always try to say it's mercy. But it's actually not, it's austerity. Does that make sense? Because most people aren't, So the idea is that these things, so regulation controls the mind. That's why it's so important. Well, these others, there has to be absolutely no connection with. Right? But in bhakti yoga, there can be connection, but it has to be regulated. Because that regulation, why the regulation? The regulation connects it to Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? Right. Okay. Does this make sense? Means directly, practically? Right? Yeah? So we don't have to get into grungy details. Okay, great. Verses 20 to 23. Describe the samadhi reached by such an advanced yogi. Established in boundless happiness, the yogi never departs from the truth because he is convinced that nothing greater can be gained. A bhakti yogi is the perfect example for this. The best practice of yoga in this age is Krishna consciousness, which is not baffling. A Krishna conscious person is so happy in his occupation that he does not aspire after any other happiness. There are many impediments, especially in this age of hypocrisy, to practicing hatha yoga, dhyana yoga, and jnana yoga. But there is no such problem in executing karma yoga or bhakti yoga. Bhagavad Gita 6:20-23 purport. Right? Because these others, if there is an impediment, it won't work. As we mentioned, the flame, it will waver. And if the mind wavers, there will be no focus. Right? So how are you going to meditate upon the Lord? But here is, you're doing service for the Lord. So even if you're not meditating, you're still connected. You're still in the yoga system. Right? But it's a yoga of meditation. So till you obtain meditation, it's not really happening. Right? So when it says they're practicing meditating for 10,000 years, that doesn't mean they're taking 10,000 years to get up to the point of meditation. No, they'll get up to that quite quickly. Right? It means there's yogis in now who get up to that point. Not that they get anywhere, necessarily. But, you know, like Prabhupada was at the Kumbh Mela. And they were walking along. He would go out walking with his sannyasis and, you know, senior men. And there was a group of some, like, young sadhus, you know, very young sadhus, but they look very bright and everything. Prabhupada asked, how old do you think they are? You know, I'll say, oh, well, they look, you know, 18, 20, this, that, and that. But Prabhupada says they're 300-400 years old. Because of yoga, they stop the breathing. So you live for 300 years, but you're not doing anything for that time. You know, if you stop the breathing and everything's inside, you know, and you do that for so many weeks or months, what are you doing? Nothing. Then you come out. Okay, great. Okay, 300 years, but you still didn't do any more activity than you would have in your regular lifetime. That's all. You know, it's just like the machine. It's good for, the machine will last, it will run, let's say, for 100 hours. Now you can turn it on, leave it for 100 hours, and then it's gone. Or you can keep turning it on and off. Wow, it's left, you know, for 10 years, you know, that's more. No, but it only ran for 100 hours. You know, it's not going to, does that make sense? So to be able to focus in other words, they're meditating for 10,000 years on the super soul. Then they're realizing the position. You understand? You know, to get from meditating super soul to full samadhi, that's what's taking them that time. So that means you have to have nothing bothering you. Right? Means, and this is for, and this can be done in satya yuga. Right? It's not actually working. You don't hear of it working so well. Some people still do it, but as a general thing, in the other yugas. You know, and I don't know if we discussed here, that means that the rule on what's the minimum you need to do to keep alive in satya yuga? Don't remember? Okay. In satya yuga, you simply have to keep the marrow in the bones. Right? In treta yuga, you have to keep the flesh on the bones. In dwapara yuga, you have to get some air. And in Kali Yuga, you have to get a handful of rice. You know, it means, in other words, a handful of food, that's all. Right? So that means they could be moving the life airs within the marrow of the bones, and the white ants can come and eat their body. So it's just a skeleton there. But they're still alive. They're still meditating. Right? So that would mean there would have to be a slight amount of, you know, you can't be distracted. Right? You know, one ant comes up and bites you. Could you imagine, you know, thousands of them, they're eating you? But you're just absorbed in meditation. So that's the meaning of the flame does not waver. Right? So they have to be pretty focused to do that. So that means they can't be connected to anything else. Is that okay? Okay. Srila Prabhupada describes some of the difficulties for the mystic yogi in renunciation to wisdom. The eight mystic perfections, anima, lagima, prapti, prakamya, and so on, which the yogi acquires during his discipline, are byproducts of his yoga practice. In samadhi, the yogi regards all these mystic perfections as insignificant. Many yogis, after mastering a few of these mystic perfections, pretend to have mastered them all, and because of a restless mind, they deviate from the goal of permanent samadhi. On the other hand, for the karma yogi, the devotee of the Lord, there is no such possibility. His heart and concentration remain fixed on his goal, because he always works for the pleasure of Krishna. He is always in samadhi, the yogi's ultimate destination. In the Lord's devotional service, the devotee experiences ever fresh emotions, and his perfections become more mature. The transcendental bliss he relishes is inexplicable and inconceivable to mundane mercenaries. Mundane mercenaries. So, in other words, we should not print this paragraph in Soldier of Fortune, right? So. So, in other words, these come as byproducts of the yoga system. But for the devotee who's always absorbed in the Lord, there's no importance here. Because absorption in the Lord is so much greater. Right? It's so much greater. But the difficulty comes is that one can get distracted by these. So that's why it's mentioned in the Anarta Nivriti, that when you're going through the six stages there, then the sixth one is where you're distracted by the benefits that come of devotional service. Does that make sense? So someone, we all understand this, right? So the point is the one is successful, one is fixed, one is successful. Right? One has gotten beyond the point where one wants to do something and can't. What one wants to do in devotional service, you know, means in the way of his sadhana, so he's able to do. Right? He's not distracted by, you know, his lack of skills or or other things like this, or absorption material like that. But from that, then recognition is there, facilities come. Then he may get distracted by that. So it's the sixth. So here we see the yogis can get distracted. It's just part of the process. There's always going to be anarthas, obstacles. So they get distracted. But the devotee won't get distracted because in Krishna consciousness there's ever more and more fresh things. So those things which are coming don't have the taste. Right? You had a little bit of that facility before. Now more of that facility is coming. Does that make sense? Right? So he's not distracted by this. And so he'll just continue. Right? Just as a side thing, this also explains the position of senior devotees who may fall away. They're not falling from the same platform that we're falling from. You understand? Because unless you can say you've gotten to that sixth level of anartha nivriti, right, then only you can say, then make a comment. But otherwise, they're falling away because of being distracted by the facilities that come from devotional service, not from the distractions of just directly their own attachments. You understand? It's different. Because they always say, oh, how could they fall? No. they're falling on a different platform. Right? Does that make sense? Or like Jarabharat. It's a different platform. That makes sense. So that's also all these things, they apply philosophically, they apply socially, they apply individually. You know, that's why they're all perfect. You know, mundane mercenaries, because someone does something for something. So technically, on the material platform, everyone's a mercenary. Just some are open about it and some are not. That's all. That's all. Bhakti yoga gives such powerful spiritual taste that it attracts even the great liberated souls, as it is confirmed in Srimad Bhagavatam 1.7.10. All different varieties of Atmaramas, those who take pleasure in Atma or spiritual self, especially those established on the path of self-realization, though freed from all kinds of material bondage, desire to render unalloyed devotional service under the personality of Godhead. This means that the Lord possesses transcendental qualities and therefore can attract everyone, including liberated souls. Right? Someone does something because of the taste that one gets from it. Right? No activity is done if it's not giving some taste. Or it leads to some taste. Right? You work hard so then you can get your house or some other facility. So maybe the working doesn't, but the money you get from it that you can buy your house, that does. Right? So because of this, everyone is working for this taste, ananda. It's the nature of the soul. So now you have liberated souls who don't get any ananda out of the material energy. But they find the service to the Lord to give that special taste. And so they are attracted by that. Right? So that's very important to note, that this is natural attraction. Right? Because here you're free from the perverted, the mundane. So it's natural. Why is this being pointed out? Because the point is, as we're saying, we'll get to the liberated state through the process of Naishkarmya. One should know that there's more beyond that. Otherwise, one may be satisfied with that. I performed the thing, it was without that. I get a taste for that. We may get attracted by the taste of the Naishkarmya as opposed to the devotional. You know what I'm saying? Otherwise, why does one become proud? Yes, I'm doing this, I'm giving up, all these other guys are so absorbed and all this. Why is that happening? Right? Someone's sadhana is very good and he feels proud, and all these other guys that are sadhana is not good. So what is he doing? He's getting a taste from proper sadhana. Right? So to do the sadhana, there must be some element of Naishkarmya, right? So he's getting some taste from that. He's elevated himself, he's getting a taste. But the problem is because now the claim of possession of that, I am austere, I am a good sadhaka. Therefore, then he'll look at others to the mundane perspective. Right? So by that, which way is he looking? Up or down?
Down.
Down. So will there be ever fresh taste? No. So it's just a matter of time before, you know, all that's left is this false ego about his sadhana, but it's actually not any better than anyone else's. Right? But he has reasons for it. And in his mind, nobody else does, right? But the reason, the point, someone else is not there. They have a reason, you know, that's why they're not there. Just of course, you know, one's own reasons are always better than anybody else's.
Could you say that success is the pillar of failure?
So
kind of reverse.
Success is the pillar of failure, you can say, but at the same time, the success is also the pillar of success, you know. Money gain, you know, money comes from money, but also money's lost from money. You know, it's just a matter of using intelligence. That's all. Yes?
If we see ourselves as fortunate in our situation emotionally, and if we had some association with someone who's not doing so well emotionally with their family or whatever like that, can we, is it okay to feel fortunate without feeling proud?
Yes. It means fortune. Fortune is a position. Fortune means if you're observed, means if you understand the fortune, means you're able to observe the environment you're in and distinguish it between something that's less fortunate. So it's a matter of intelligence. The difficulty comes is then when the mind brings in the false ego. That's where the problem comes. Right? But to be able to observe it, you know, that let's say one is, you know, of all places in the universe to be within the Holy Dham, you can't get better than that. You know, and if one's able to spend more time, right? Because Nectar Devotion is saying, you know, if you spend, you know, a year or 6 months or even a fortnight, you know, in the Holy Dham, then one is, you know, liberated. So how greatly fortunate that is. But why has that come? You know, because we're so intelligent, such great devotees. That, like that, you know, it's like, no, it's because of the grace of Guru and Krishna and the Vaishnavas. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, so that's the... the whole point. Does that make sense? So being able to appreciate it, and then what will that appreciation do? It will invoke more Krishna consciousness. In other words, how kind Krishna is, how kind the devotees are, right? You know, how kind the Dham is. So like that, then one is able to develop. If one becomes proud, then there'll be a problem. In other words, we don't see ourselves as the cause. The ultimate cause is always Krishna. We can be involved in the process of causation, but we can be someone who's operating, but even our operation is as an instrument. Because when we try to operate it on our own, it doesn't work out so good, right? But if we operate as an instrument, then it works very well. Because what we're operating is something that's already established between the Lord and His internal potency. Right, so then what we do, then if we do it connected to them, then the material results that come, the material cause, won't actually be material, it'll be spiritual. Because the formal cause, the person who's the formal cause is also the material cause. Right? It's just a fuller manifestation than a partial manifestation. Does that make sense? So if we are the instrument in assisting them in serving Krishna, right? Then what we do doesn't work, you know, as a negative in the material cause. So it's like the form. It acts like a manifestation of the formal cause, right? So we get spiritual results. Does that make sense? Yes. Is that all? No, we're not going to do that. Okay, so let's go over to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, not bad. We're getting somewhere. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is big. I was thinking, wow, we're almost done. No, we still got more. This is the biggest chapter, no? Huh? Till now. Oh, there's bigger. Maybe. We're not revealing, but maybe there's one. Okay.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jainitai Gaura Premanandi.